The executor has a role in that they have to distribute the estate and give those assets to the trusts.
You're listening to Australia's podcast for accountants, Tax Talks, the podcast to grow your firm.
Welcome to episode 278 of Tax Talks. This is Heide Robson, and thank you to Class for sponsoring this episode. I hope that 2021 started better for you than 2020 ended, and that you had a nice break, although that is probably a distant memory for you by now. I have to ask you a favor. Please give me a week to warm up again. So today and tomorrow, let's go through two interviews I recorded in late December. And then from next week on, we will start with interviews recorded right now in February 2021. And also, my new mic hasn't arrived yet because I ordered it far too late. But hopefully in 2 weeks, I can give you better audio quality than before. So today, let's go through 10 questions around testamentary trusts. As you know, testamentary trusts are a great way to transfer wealth from one generation to the next, but they also come with their own issues. Here's Paul McEnroe of Clearhorn Brisbane giving you an answer to 10 questions about those issues. The first question is, should there be just one testamentary trust for all children together? Or is it common to create one trust for each child? So let's say you have three children. Should your will create three testamentary trusts, so one for each child? Or is it better to just have one trust for all three children together?
Question number one. One trust per child or one for all together?
One testamentary trust for each child. Is that common?
It is common, and ordinarily, if a client came to us with three children, for example, depending on the age of the child, it's often appropriate to create a testamentary trust for each child. Eventually, those children will want to take, I guess, their share of the estate and deal with their own, I guess, portion as they see fit, not necessarily tied to their siblings. So that's often a consideration for people when establishing testamentary trusts. So yeah, it is common, create more than one trust. I'll take my example. I've got three children, but I have a trust with one testamentary trust. My children are all at a young age. I'll probably revisit that as the years go on and those kids become older. But most deeds would allow, you know, some form of sub-trust if that were suitable in the circumstances. But yeah, it's not an uncommon characteristic to have more than one trust in a will.
So if all children are minors, are under 18, then it is usually better to have just one testamentary trust in your will. But if all your children are adults, then it's better to give a testamentary trust to each of them for future family peace.
Yeah, look, I don't know that there's one better or worse approach. It's kind of the approach that I see works for clients with young children. If one party or one parent passes away, often it's easier for mum or dad to manage one trust rather than, you know, three trusts that might be passed to those children 20 or 30 years down the road. That is often the consideration that, well, you know, kids are 3 and 5. It's unlikely if one parent passed away in the short term that those trusts would be going or would be passing on to the children for many, many years. So oftentimes when the kids are young, the parents will opt for one testamentary trust controlled by the other parent, which ultimately will go to the children at some point down the road. But that's generally the consideration as to how many trusts you have in a will. It'll be, you know, what are the assets that are going to fall to those trusts and at what point will those trusts be handed on to the next generation?
Question number two, common for a testamentary trust to be empty?
Second question, is it common that testamentary trusts are empty for many years? So the first parent dies, the will of this first parent creates the testamentary trusts, but then these testamentary trusts are actually empty apart from a small token amount until the second parent dies. Is that quite common?
Yeah, it can be. Oftentimes, a will might give certain assets to the trust, therefore, I guess, forming the trust property. I haven't seen or written any wills that would give a small amount, like a settlement sum in a discretionary trust, just to start the trust. That tends not to happen so much in the testamentary trust world. Generally, in a testamentary trust, the trust will receive either particular assets or a portion of the estate or the whole of the estate if there's one trust. And then it comes down to a matter of, well, what assets did that person own that were not assets held jointly with their spouse? In some circumstances, there will be trusts that have very limited assets in them for a period of time. I haven't seen a lot of that. Ultimately, if there were no need for that trust, if it had a very nominal amount of assets, I would think that the trust would probably be vested unless there was some purpose for it. Now, in the past, prior to recent changes to the law around taxation of testamentary trust, there might have been a reason why that trust might be established in order to gain some tax advantages, but that is now lessened by the changes to the law in that area, so that fairly unlikely that a trust with nominal assets would continue for too long. It would just be an administrative burden on the family.
Question number three, can you change the trustee of a testamentary trust?
Can you ever bring another trustee or replace the trustee in the testamentary trust?
Yeah, so this always goes back to the mantra of trust lawyers, read the deed. The deed will generally provide provisions to allow either a replacement or co-trustee. But again, it just can't, there's no one rule as to how that works. And it's a matter of reading the individual terms of each trust document in order to determine what that trust allows or doesn't allow.
Question number four, protected from family law?
Are testamentary trusts protected from family law to a similar extent to other trusts? Is it similar, or are testamentary trusts more protected than other discretionary trusts?
Look, the short answer is that it really does depend on how the trust operates. The way family court, and this is a very generic explanation, the way the family court looks at any trust is, again, what are the terms of the trust, but also who ultimately controls this trust? Who is the alter ego of this trust? And if that is solely one party to the relationship or marriage that is in dispute, that party controls it absolutely, then more than likely that asset may be a pool asset.
Just like any other discretionary trust. So there's really not any difference when it comes to family law.
There are some aspects in that it wasn't, I guess, the set law being mum or dad's intention that these assets would be, I guess, part of a family court dispute, but that's probably a lesser consideration than who ultimately controls that asset. Now, there's been many, many cases litigated in the family court. The ones that are successful have few similar themes. One is that control of that trust or trusts is not solely with the party to the marriage. There's a case that's, I think, back from maybe even as late as 2015 or even earlier, called Morton and Morton, where two brothers were in control of a trust. And control needs to be more than just, I guess, there in name only. It needs to be genuine control. And in that case, the trust was genuinely managed for both brothers' family. There was a case only in the last year or so where the sister controlled the brother's trust and the brother controlled the sister's trust. Now, that might be a cute way to manage a trust, but in that case, the facts were that the sister genuinely actually managed the trust fund for her brother and not just did what the brother wanted, and vice versa. So that's kind of a strange scenario. It's probably not the norm, but in those circumstances, it was enough to defend against that trust or those trust assets becoming part of the marriage. But the short answer is people always want the lawyers to say, oh, you'll be safe with this type of trust. None of these cases are won because of the way the trust deed is written. or anything like that. It's always about the evidence provided to the court as to who controls this trust, and is that the one party who is in those property settlement proceedings.
But I think, Paul, you just gave us a very good argument to just create one trust for all children. Because let's say you have three children, you just create one trust. No child will control the trust, and hence no child's spouse can then attack the trust. When I say child, I really mean the adult child. Yeah. Let's say somebody has three sons and creates just one testamentary trust, and the entire estate goes into this testamentary trust. If now one of the wives of these three sons tries to attack the testamentary trust, they can't, because the other two brothers are sitting and controlling their share of the trust. So that means the only risk is that the three brothers have a fallout and take assets from each other, but then at least the assets stay within the direct bloodline. Whereas if you create three separate trusts, then each of the spouses, each of the wives could attack that trust and take half of the assets. And assuming the asset split is 50-50 or can take more, whatever the family court then decides, but could take their share of the assets, and hence the assets would leave the family if you now, you know, if you define this, the wife as not being part of the family anymore. So that would be an argument to just create one testamentary trust, because that way at least there's some protection from departing spouses.
That's right. I mean, I think in a scenario where there are three siblings or even two siblings who genuinely manage one trust for their respective families, I think that trust has very solid arguments as to why this trust and those trust assets should not be part of that marital pool to be divided.
Question number 5, family trust election.
Next question, family trust election. You never make that in the last will and testament, you make that separate, and you just make it by filling out the ATO form, sending it to the ATO, correct? It's not something you make in the will, correct?
That's correct. It's a creature of tax law, not anything else. So it's something you do as a matter of, I guess, as needed under the tax laws.
Question number 6, actual address or PO box.
Next question. The address of the deceased is just listed as a PO box. That surprised me that you could list a PO box on a formal document like this. Is that common, or you usually use the street address?
Ordinarily, it would be the street address. Sometimes people might not want to record their home address for particular reasons. In my former life, I was a police officer and a detective, so I didn't put my street address on anything. I wasn't recorded even on the electoral roll for, you know, hopefully obvious reasons.
So you didn't vote.
Voted, but you can record yourself as a silent voter. So you don't, in theory, I don't think you show up on the electoral roll if someone does a search. I don't know the full background, but it allows you to be a little bit more hidden than usual. I don't know the circumstances of this person, but that may be a reason why. But ordinarily, it would be at their home address.
Question number 7, executor versus trustee.
Then it says that I appoint my spouse to be the executor and trustee of this will. Is there a difference between an executor and a trustee of a will, or it's kind of the same again?
No, they are two distinct roles. So the executor obviously has the ability to call in assets, pay liabilities, and make distributions according to the will. That's their role. There is also a trust relationship for those assets. So, for example, if this person operated a business as a sole trader, for example, well, there would need to be a trustee who would manage that business going forward in their capacity. So that role is distinct from the executor's role, and there is a role of trust there. And that's why ordinarily, and I've never seen it otherwise, those two roles are generally forged in the one person, in this case, the one or the spouse, but they are two distinct roles.
Question number 8, can you cease to act as an executor?
In the next paragraph, it talks about a general trustee. So the wife is made the general trustee, and it says that if she ceases to act, then I appoint my children to take her place as a general trustee. And the question is, what does this cease to act mean? You know, at what stage can the children come in and take over?
Yeah, so ordinarily, once you've got a grant of probate, it is quite difficult to get out of that grant because obviously the court has vested significant powers in you. You applied for it, and therefore, you know, the court is not going to lightly remove you from that role. But say, for example, the spouse obtained a grant of probate and then passed away. Or perhaps the person didn't even obtain a grant of probate and they passed away. So in those circumstances, the role would fall to those alternate executors and trustees.
Question number 9. What if there is no trust established?
And now let's say the spouse doesn't create the testamentary trust that the last will stipulated. Is that possible? Because my understanding is the testamentary trust is not created with the will or with the passing of the will maker. Testamentary trust is only created through the executor and trustee. So if the general trustee doesn't create the testamentary trust, then there isn't really anything anybody can do, correct?
I don't think that would be right. My view is that the testamentary trust is established once there are assets that form part of that trust estate. So yes, the executor has a role in that they have to distribute the estate and give those assets to the trusts. So looking generally, there will be, I guess, a creation clause.
Right.
And then there is a gifting clause. Now, the gifting clause generally gives those assets to the trust. If the executor, for whatever reason, says, "Oh, I'm not doing any of that. I'm going to give it to myself or another person," well, that executor is in breach of the will and they're not adhering to their duties as the executor, which from there follows a number of things. One, it would be the beneficiaries who should have received assets from the estate would have a cause of action against the trust, against the executor to probably remove that person as an executor. And then if those assets have been distributed not in accordance with the will, to pursue for breach of that duty.
What is the issue again around default beneficiaries? Why not have one as a precaution if the trustee fails to distribute before 30th of June?
Yeah, so our firm took a policy decision many, many years ago that we would pursue asset protection above the taxation consequences of not having a default beneficiary.
I see, because having a default beneficiary means that, for example, the spouse of this default beneficiary then would have stronger claims over trust assets?
Not necessarily. More on the, I guess, the income distribution side of it. So if there were a default distribution of income and that were to fall to a default beneficiary who was bankrupt, then that obviously provides an asset protection risk to the trust. Our view was that a trustee assessment was preferable to that asset protection risk. That was essentially, I guess, the policy reason behind why we don't have that default beneficiary.
And so how do you stop the trustee from being taxed if there failure to distribute?
Yeah, sorry. We also took the view that very unlikely that clients don't distribute the income of their trust. In our experience, yeah, it happens from time to time, but in the main, most clients who have trusts distribute their income by 30 June and do so obviously with the help of accountants and the like. I guess we weighed up what's the downside, and I guess part of what we would do in accordance with this will, we would give a letter of wishes which explains some of those aspects to the trustee of these testamentary trusts as to what they need to do year on year and make sure that they get those resolutions done by the relevant time.
Yes, I agree with you that all trust income is distributed 99.9% of the time, but timing is usually an issue around the 30th of June. But that's a different topic around backdating, etc.
Question number 10, liability for debts of a testamentary trust.
One last question, and that is the personal liability of beneficiaries and trustees' personal liability. So that's basically saying the beneficiaries are never liable for any debts of the trust, and it says that the trustee can access trust assets to satisfy liabilities it incurred for the sake of the trust. But if those trust assets are not sufficient, then would the trustee be personally liable?
Yes, they would. So that really is a restatement of the law in that, well, beneficiaries are not responsible for the actions of the trustee, and that trustees have the right to be indemnified from trust assets for liabilities they incur in their role as trustee. But when that trust has insufficient assets in order to allow for the either the recoupment or the exoneration of the trustee, then the trustee becomes personally liable. Because at law, the trustee is the person who is contracting. So if a trustee contracts to buy a property, it is the trustee who is the party to that contract. It's not the trust. The trust isn't a living thing. It is the trustee. So that trustee is the person who gets sued. And if you're the seller of a property, you don't really care that that trustee doesn't have enough money from the trust assets in order to pay you. It's, well, you're saying that you as the trustee, whether in that role or not, want to buy this property, and you're saying that there is enough money.
So an individual trustee is a lot less protected than a director, because if a director, for example, buys a property and then subsequently the company hits rough times and the company can't pay its debts, then the director is only personally liable if they traded while insolvent, which let's assume that wasn't the case. So then the director is not personally liable. But if the same scenario then applied to a trustee, then they would be personally liable.
Correct. And that's why best practice is to have a corporate trustee of any trust, whether it be testamentary or otherwise.
Welcome back. Just a quick reminder that the law has changed with respect to what is accepted income. Until June last year, it was income from any asset, even if that asset was contributed to the testamentary trust later on. But this has changed, and now accepted income can only come from original trust assets. We covered this in Update 25 in December. In the next episode, episode 279, and that will be the last interview recorded in 2020, and it will also be a short interview. In the next episode, Jeff Steen of Brown Radstein Lawyers in Sydney will talk about to what extent losses in a discretionary trust trigger the need for a family trust election. Until then, thank you for listening, and thank you to Class for their support. Bye for now, and see you in the next episode.